things on here, and I know that a couple of you need to be gone by 10 o'clock. We may actually be done by that time, but if we're not, then I know that you will be excused, and the rest of us will sit here and finish up. Let's see. Why don't we just go ahead and go right to the public hearing on House Bill 2236. So I'll open a public hearing on that. And Jim, you want to walk us through the SMS on this, please?
Yes, sir. This is on House Bill 2236. What the measure does, it requires the Oregon Department of Administrative Services to adopt rules concerning property or leasing rates charged by state agencies that rent or lease property or facilities to other state agencies. This measure also requires the AS to review rates biannually and report to the Joint Legislative Committee on Ways and Means before January 1st of each odd number year. House Bill 2236 will require DAS to adopt rules to ensure that the property rental or leasing rates charged by a state agency that furnishes property or facilities to another state agency are competitive with property rental or leasing rates charged in the private sector, and review biannually the property rental and leasing rates of state agencies that rent or lease properties or facilities to other state agencies. And we have Bill Foster here from DAS to discuss the bill.
Okay. Great. This was, just to give you a little bit of a history on this committee, this was a bill that we had on the House Interim Committee on Government Operations and Oversight asked for this draft, and then we had introduced it as a committee bill at our December meeting. This is an issue that we talked about during the course of the interim with Government Operations and Oversight, and I know it's an issue that Representative Butler had really brought to our attention, and we started looking at it a little bit closer. And with that, Representative Butler, do you want to add anything or say anything about this before we go to public testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm most anxious to have the Department of Administrative Services assist us in telling us how they would go about effectively reporting the entire cost of operations of the buildings that they serve. And the rates that they charge, so I'm anxious to proceed with that.
Okay, great. Then if there's not any questions, Bill, let me have you go ahead and come up and make sure that you introduce yourself for the record, please. Oh, and the piggy bank is there, so just as a reminder to everyone, it's the written rule on acronyms. If you, the first time you say it, then after that you can use the acronym, but if you use the acronym first or don't follow it up immediately with an explanation of what the acronym means, it costs you a dollar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bill Foster. I'm the acting administrator of the Facilities Division of the Department of Administrative Services, and I'm appearing this morning to provide information and describe the current statutory requirements and practices for state agencies to charge other agencies. I'd like to first start by talking a little bit about current practices by the Department of Administrative Services. The department has two types of rental programs for owned buildings, one that is self-support for specialty uses, and the other is uniform rent for office space. Rent for these facilities are developed on a cost recovery basis. Costs for all uniform rent facilities are pooled and divided equally across the total square footage. Self-support rents are on an individual building basis. ORS 276-390 requires the department to submit a schedule of rents to the emergency board for approval for the use in the following biennium. In both cases, DAS strives to keep the rates at or below private market. As far as other agencies are required, in addition to the buildings that the Department of Administrative Services rents to other agencies, several other agencies own buildings that they rent out. Some agencies sublease a portion of the facilities that they lease from other state agencies. In all these cases, the leases are reviewed and approved by the Department of Administrative Services. And ORS 276-385 requires that the department negotiate with other state agencies who own or operate buildings to determine a fair rental rate when the facilities are used by other than the owning agency. Then the last area just to touch on is land leases. In addition to buildings, the department leases property it owns to other state agencies. Periodically, the department reviews the value of the property and attempts to set the rate near private market rates. Other agencies may also lease some of their property to other state agencies, but Department of Administrative Services is not part of that process and does not have any record of these arrangements. As we understand the intent of the bill, it would be for the department to develop some review process of these rates to assure that they're competitive, and then to report findings and recommendations about the rates to the Ways and Means Committee during the legislative session. Any questions?
Questions for Mr. Foster?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to know, I'd like to get deeper, a little bit deeper into the formula to assure that we have full costing in the property rental or leasing rates so that we can compare those competitively with the market rates. And Bill, maybe you can bring us through that. And I noticed we have George Dunford here. Perhaps someone could speak to the costing in the process, the accounting of the costing for the rates that are established that we would be looking at under 276.385 through 390.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, the formulas, when you try to compare to private markets, don't totally align because there are certain kinds of costs that are built into state formulation of these rates and what the private sector has to contend with, you know, in terms of taxes or profits or other kinds of things.
If I may, yes, I think that's the kernel of what I'm looking for is that alignment. We don't have to make a profit, but I don't need to be feathering nests either. So I guess what I'm looking for, Bill, as much as possible, is to try and figure out what are the items so that we can compare. And again, the kernel of it is that we don't align. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to bring that alignment. I'd like to have a better feel for that.
Certainly. Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, perhaps we can maybe show some examples and provide that back to the committee to help articulate it. There are certainly some elements of it, you know, custodial services, operations and maintenance, utility costs, etc., that would directly correlate. And they're the same kinds of costs, but the formulation is somewhat different with some of the other aspects. Obviously, a private provider often is going to have some level of loan or debt, as do we with many of these facilities. So those align. So, you know, we certainly can articulate that for you. Now, I guess one of the things that perhaps we were not totally clear on was whether the focus of this was across state government or more on the Department of Administrative Services.
Representative Butler, do you have
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I recognize that the Department of Administrative Services is involved in leases outside of the Salem and Portland areas, perhaps not as much, on leases. And I don't know. I guess there's a question of how many properties the state even has that the Department of Administrative Services is administering through the Physical Facilities Division. It's an enigma to me. I don't know where we're at in that regard. Yeah. I do know that there are agencies within the state of Oregon that do their own leasing, and I don't know that they have lease divisions. Does your division, for instance, when the state police decide that they want a new building in Central Point, And they're going to lease that facility. I don't know that they own their facilities anywhere in the state, but when they're going to lease that, who do they consult with?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, in the case of the Central Point facility, that was something that state police approached the Department of Administrative Services about. We, in fact, brought that to the legislature, and we own that facility and lease it specifically to them on this self-support basis. So it's an individual building, and the cost of that building is related to the actual costs of that to the department.
Mr. Chair, I would present then to the committee that perhaps that's a good place to start. There's a fairly recent facility, specific design constructed. There are other state police buildings that are at least that I'm aware of that maybe. When we're talking about, you know, what's the cost of owning that building versus the cost of having rented that facility. Until this moment, I was just using that example and had no knowledge of it. So I guess that's the kind of information I would like to be able to do, is to take, by example, some of the facilities that are in the Salem-Portland area, some of the facilities that are outside the area, have an opportunity to examine those particular facilities side by side with comparable per square foot leasing, and just get some idea as to what items are thrown into the overall formula. Then I think, Mr. Chair, that we could go ahead with, if Department of Administrative Services is concerned about what facilities and where, then we could address that, or concerned about the development of the formula as to what disclosure and what depth of disclosure is necessary. I think that would be an appropriate time to address that. But I think that's a good start. And I didn't know that the facility, I just was using that as an example, because I knew that it was a state police facility and it's a fairly new one. So if we could start there, that would give us, I think, a point of reference that we could look at that. And then I think that they're the committee members, as I look up and down the committee, I think we're all astute enough folks that we could, you know, ask the question side by side, why are you doing it this way when private business may not do it exactly that way?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, perhaps we could also give just a little context to make sure that the committee is understanding really our scope. The department has a little over 20% of the non-university system space that it owns. So we're one of several agencies that have fairly significant holdings of property. Corrections, for instance, actually owns more than we do. Our total is about 3.2 million square feet. We lease, for the benefit of other agencies, about 4 million square feet. So we actually lease more than we own. So it's a combination, and we try to make the decision about when we're owning and when we're leasing based on what makes the most sense and some of the characteristics of the agency and those kinds of things. But, you know, if in fact you're looking at a broader view of this across state government, then, you know, it's then collecting information from other agencies as well.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Butler,
thank you. I don't think that my district is necessarily unique, but I do have inquiries from contractors and private parties from time to time that ask about, you know, why is the state entering into this kind of an agreement? Why are they moving out of this facility in exchange for a larger one over here, that where they're trying to combine human services and employment into a one-stop shop? And so I frequently am without, you know, the kinds of report that would be necessary to say, because they have reported to us that it is more competitive for us to own our own building or for us to lease this larger building than it is to have leased all of these other smaller facilities. Those are the kinds of things that I'm trying to get to. Again, I think that we all probably receive some kinds of inquiries from our constituents as to why the state has made the decision here versus there, this building versus that building.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, the issue that you speak of with the Department of Human Services, who is the biggest holder of leases, would really not be subject to this report that you're describing, because the vast majority, there's very little that they occupy that we own. So those are mostly all private leases, and we are involved in that negotiation process, and they come to us when they want to make moves and consolidations, and we try to walk them through some kind of process to assure that that makes sense. But, you know, it then becomes really kind of their call that that is what, in fact, they programmatically need.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that explanation from Mr. Foster, and I appreciate the fact that the report does just provide that wherever we are owning property, that our rates that we're charging to the agency, those rates are competitive with those in the private sector. And so, again, perhaps that was a bad example. And one example that I can now use, I guess, from my own district is the fact that I recall, I'm not so old that I don't remember, when we built a facility in Ontario for Department of Transportation, and again, this is another agency that owns buildings that they come to you for certain amounts of information for, Bill, but when the building was built for Department of Transportation, a couple of thousand square feet, it housed the PUC, Department of Transportation, the maintenance yards, Highway Division, the State Police, and DMV for licensing of vehicles and folks that were getting their licenses, driver's licenses and other permits. Since that time, the 2,000-foot facility was replaced with a probably office space and otherwise, close to 10,000 square feet in another location for just the maintenance and the maintenance division, with offices, about 10,000 offices and meeting rooms. And then the Department of Transportation has built a brand new building of about 10,000 feet that just houses their office for their office portion. State Police is somewhere else. DMV is somewhere else. PUC isn't involved. No other agencies are involved. And I don't see an additional road mile that's being maintained or built in that process. And so I look at that and I say, what we used to do with 2,000 square feet and five different agencies, we've now got five different agencies all in their own different buildings. Two of those are that were housed in the original 2,000 square feet are now taking 20,000 square feet, mm-hmm. and we don't have any more road miles, no more lane miles that we're actually... So I guess in that regard, and if we had a template to know what our private rental is versus a leasing charge rate, private rental from the private sector versus the leasing charge rate, then at least that would give me some ammo to go and say, hey, it's cheaper for the Department of Transportation to go build their own buildings than it is for them to lease from the folks downtown. Those are the kinds of things. Not to mention, Mr. Chair, that probably the second most valuable commercial spot in the entire city of Ontario is where this building was located, in which they chose to return to the same location with that particular building, which could have been probably $15 a square foot commercial property, and instead we have a very handy place in the middle of all of the shopping centers in Ontario for the people from the Department of Transportation to go to work in the morning. Now, I don't begrudge them a nice place to go to work. It's just that if it had been four or five blocks one direction or another, they could have had it in the commercial area as opposed to the freeway shopping area. And that's, you know, again, it's a decision that those folks make. But in that regard, Mr. Chair, I would give you a very, very long shot of ever trying to pass any kind of a gasoline tax in Eastern Oregon as a result of that issue, because they just said, we've got the funds to do it, and we're going to build it, and you have no say over it at this particular point. Because it was approved in the 1997 legislative assembly, their budget, to build, and I just wouldn't ever care to have that situation in anybody's district again over the issues that we've got here. So, and that might be give us a template of how this thing can be resolved for us too.
So, Representative Butler, let me ask you a question. So the Department of Transportation cited in the middle of the commercial district in Ontario, and now because the Department of Transportation owns it, it's now exempt from property tax, so there's no local revenue in that respect for the local governments, and because the property could have been used for commercial use, there's no rents being paid as far as the economy in Ontario is concerned.
Exactly, Mr. Chair. The facility, and again, it was the facility located, which had been located there, placed there 50 years before, and 50 years before, it was just a spot next to Highway 30 at the particular time. Since that time, Freeway 84 Interstate has come through that particular portion of the state, and rather than move this particular facility several blocks away from the freeway, they have used freeway retail commercial, is what we call it, retail commercial, and couldn't be dissuaded from doing that. As a matter of fact, at the very last minute, they were dissuaded from blocking off two major arterials to the balance of the commercial area in that particular area, so that the rest of the commercial traffic does have access to that particular area. But as to the adjacent hotels, adjacent restaurants, interstate freeway restaurants, national brand chains, and the major shopping center immediately adjacent, or the hamburger joint, the national hamburger chain immediately adjacent, those folks do have access to their facilities, but now this new facility, this new brand new facility by ODOT, is square smack dab in the middle of Ontario's second most prime real estate development, and not unknown to them at the time when these decisions were being made. I'm very anxious about that, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you.
That's a decision that this particular bill wouldn't necessarily address, but it might give us some of the information as to how these decisions are made when we are competitively trying to price facilities. Again, ODOT has a policy, I understand, that they do not lease any of their facilities. They must own or build is their policy internally, is what I was told at the time.
Is that a federal statute by any chance, Mr. Buster?
Mr. Chairman, I do know that they do in fact release some. Now, the largest proportion is clearly owned, but they lease space in Salem, for instance.
Okay. Are there other questions for Mr. Buster? I do have a couple, and you may have mentioned this, and I missed it. For most of the leases that the Department of Administrative Services writes, you use a triple net concept for those leases.
Mr. Chairman, it's a mix. Many of them are full service. Some of them are triple net,
okay.
And it depends on kind of the needs and the particular issues about what makes sense, best sense for the agency.
Okay. And then when you lease for the benefit of other agencies, are you saying that Department of Administrative Services then is being the is acting as a leasing agent, and so you're negotiating with a private party for an agency to then come in and occupy a space, but you've negotiated the lease and such.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay, that's what I wanted to make sure of that. And then the other thing is that when agencies own their own buildings, such as the ODOT example, do they generally charge themselves some kind of a uniform rate, whether it's a lease rate or not isn't the issue, but do they charge themselves some kind of uniform rate so that they develop within their own budget a reserve fund for maintenance, so that as the building needs to be upgraded, whether it's carpets or a plumbing thing that goes wrong, or heating and ventilation that goes haywire, or any number of things that, of course, we know that high traffic buildings can suffer from, they have a maintenance plan, or do they just sort of, they own the building, they occupy it, they pay the mortgage on it, and if there's debt owed on it, and then just sort of sit there and then hope nothing breaks?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think it varies. Some agencies do a little more in that regard. I know we have been working with the Department of Transportation about a concept of potentially having a Department of Administrative Services acquire from them the building on the mall and operating it under our program rather than under theirs. And currently they have no reserve fund and they aren't charging themselves rent. So that's part of why this particular concept might make sense for particularly that building. But there was some statutory changes put into effect several years ago that allowed agencies to set up these reserve funds. But to my knowledge, to date, none of them that had not done it previously have availed themselves of that. So, there's
other buildings fall in disrepair, and
well, there's a variety of approaches. For instance, another agency that owns a building, and it is a building, is the State Lands Division. They contract with us to do any of the leasing and to do the operation and maintenance of that building, and we work with them to make sure the repairs are done adequately. And they charge a rate that's equivalent to the uniform rent rate.
And they charge it to themselves as well, so that it creates the fund to which they can then keep the building up to date and upgraded.
And Mr. Chairman, that particular agency is a unique one because that is an investment of the Common School Fund.
Right.
And so it has some special provisions and also access to money.
Okay. One of the other things, and you mentioned the ODOT building on the mall, and I wasn't going to mention it, but since you did, you've opened the door. If that were to transpire, mm-hmm. and Department of Administrative Services then purchased that building from the Department of Transportation, mm-hmm. and now you're managing it, mm-hmm. and because of the uniform rents, are other uniform rents of buildings that DAS owns going to be affected by that building, or do you set the rates up so that every building stands on its own?
Mr. Chairman, that was what I was trying to describe in the beginning. We have kind of two programs. One is uniform rent where they're pooled, and that's generally the office space. And then we have the self-support where it's an individual building by building.
Okay.
The ones on the mall that are the office, such as the transportation building would be, is pooled. Now, what we were attempting to do in the analysis that we did that led to taking this proposal forward was to figure out a way that would have little or no impact on the overall pool, so that by adding that, we weren't actually increasing the cost to other agencies.
Well, I'm going to put something on the record here, members, and I'm going to be very pretty blunt about it, and that is that...
Blunt? You?
Yes. For once, I'm going to be blunt.
Okay.
and that is little effect is not acceptable to me, and there's a number of members of the legislature that feel the same way. It better have no effect, because I don't think the Department of Administrative Services should bail ODOT out of a quagmire that they have created themselves by their lack of responsibility for being able to take care of their property. And to expect all of the other agencies to bail them out because of their own incompetence is not acceptable. So it better have no effect on the uniform rents of the other agencies. Because if it does, that's something we would have to definitely take a look at and And it, so I'll stop there.
Mr. Chair, I think that the language in House Bill 2236 could help us with that particular discussion, because again, we'll need to develop it a little further. As I read the statutes involving what constitutes state buildings under 276, that's sequential. I have some questions. It talks about uniform rates, and some of the uniform rates appear to be blended with other kinds of things. So there's some blending that's going on to shift costs, and I appreciate this discussion. But again, if we had the details from Mr. Foster's physical facilities division as to how they blend those rates, and I realize that probably gets us back into a ways and means discussion, Bill. Mm-hmm. But I think that it would then give us a starting point to examine the competitive rates of rental property and leasing rates being charged by the private sector.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brown.
I got a question. I don't know who to direct it to, but my understanding is that the legislature is responsible for this building.
Yes, that's correct.
And the Supreme Court building. Okay, how responsible have we been in having reserves and doing what we're asking of other agencies?
Well, Representative Brown, since you brought that up, that is a very good question. And actually, we have not been very, very responsible in the funding for the legislative facilities people to be able to take care of all of the needs on the Capitol. One of the things, well, as an example, when you go into the wings and you notice that this carpet that was laid there in 1972 when the building was built is still there. Now,
I love that color.
The durability of the carpet, as an example. It's terrific that they bought a very high quality at the time that had the durability, and they've been able to maintain it. But the problem with it is that it's not contemporary in terms of decor and that sort of thing. So that is an issue. If you go into the governor's office, again, there are some pretty worn areas in the governor's office, in which I think we should take pride in our Capitol and in our building and in all of the offices. And sometimes I wonder if we're not letting things get in the way that don't allow us to keep this in prideful condition. This is a discussion that actually has occurred with the Capitol Foundation, of which I'm a member, and some of the exterior sorts of things. And the question that came up there was whether or not the Capitol Foundation was responsible for the interior and for maintenance. And it's very clear that in the charge of the Capitol Foundation that they are not. They are basically in charge of the exterior and beautification. And that's really their charge. And internal maintenance of the building is left to us. And we, quite frankly, need to start making sure that we put enough money in the legislative budget to maintain our Capitol and our Supreme Court in a more prideful manner, I guess is the best way that I would put it. One of the things that I get very agitated about is the fact that we have folks actually in our body, in the legislature, and over the years that have done this, that want to cut us so short, and they're afraid of maybe they're not afraid, they don't want to spend the money for government. They see it as a waste, and they don't want to spend the money for government to have a reasonable and nice facility to do their in which to do their work and to do the people's
I've
work.
I've got a solution for it. We can sell the ODOT building down in Ontario and take the capital gains and get new carpet for that.
By golly, that's what we like. Thinking ahead. Okay. Are there other questions?
Restaurant, huh?
Are there other questions for Bill?
No.
Okay. Bill, thank you very much for the information. And if you can the information that you were going to, that you'll provide to us by example and that sort of thing, if you can get that to us through Jim would be terrific.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we'll be happy to pull some things together. It may take us just a little while get all of the information that would be most usable for a continuation of the discussion, but we will do that.
And what would you sort of guesstimate might be a little while? Are you thinking a couple of weeks?
Yes.
Or are you thinking 8 months?
Mr. Chairman, I think probably 2 weeks would be more than adequate.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And if you'll just keep Jim apprised of how that, so like if you know, a couple of weeks goes by and you're still needing a little more time, just let Jim know.
Certainly.
And this bill was only noticed for public hearing today. We're and this obviously is a discussion that does need to continue, members. So what we'll do is continue to continue with that. And I think the other thing that we might do, a good suggestion is to is to hear from some of the local landlords at the next hearing on regarding this bill, in terms of how that affects the local economy and space available and that sort of thing.
And Mr. Chair, in that regard too, then the formulas could be shared. The things that I know that Mr. Foster's division is not penurious with the information that they gather. They share that information. It's public information, and perhaps we could get some of the outside private thinking as to what items should be included in the kinds of contracts. You know, are we leasing buildings that we're providing heavier maintenance and custodial activities for of our own motion, when that might be a service that could be provided with the building when we lease it from the third party? I do know that the Fed Department does that they will lease a building what we call wet, that is triple net, and you provide even the custodial folks that come in and do the regular custodial work. So those are the kinds of things that I think the private industry might bring to the table. Mr. Chair, thank you.
Thank you. Bill, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Now, is there anyone else that wishes to testify on House Bill 2236? Seeing none, I will close the hearing on House Bill 2236. And now I'm going to open a... You'll remember, members, that we had a discussion. I'm going to open an informational meeting with the Department of Administrative Services also. You'll remember that we had quite a discussion last week with regards to audits, and George is back with us again today to kind of discuss the audits that were done from July of 2003 through December 31st of 2004, and these are audits that were done for the Department of Administrative Services. So just to give you a little bit of background there, and then with that, George, let me go ahead and turn it over to you to discuss the document and further your report.
Pardon me, Mr. Chair. I've been dodging the cold here of late, and I think I'm going to catch one pretty soon, so we'll see how I do today. And that means I'm about 80% today, so that, unfortunately for me, not for you.
He's been near my grandkids, too, though.
I've been near you, too. So. And I might add, Mr. Chair, my name is George Dunford. I am the Internal Audit Manager for the Department of Administrative Services, and I'm very happy to be here today to present some information to you and all the committee members. You mentioned earlier that these were audits that were done for the Department of Administrative Services, and I just want to make sure we use the correct terminology. They were done to the Department of Administrative Services. And I'm also here to... Oh, thank you. Thank you, Mr. President. I'm also here to contribute for Lori Warner, who forgot to... Actually, she probably couldn't reach the piggy bank the last session, the last hearing, because it was up on the...
It was up here.
Yeah, I will go ahead and make my contribution as well. I'm going to do my very best not to use acronyms, however, if I do. Hopefully that will cover it.
You've got money in the bank.
I've got money in the bank. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
You have been provided with a copy of a summary document that is actually part of the agency request budget document. And I did not write this document. It is basically a compilation of quotes from audit findings, the management response, and the corrective action with respect to what the management response said we would do and what the audit finding found that we should do. So they are in order. I'll stick with the order that you have, just because I think it'd be easier and it'll flow faster.
Okay, that'd be great.
And I will move along as quickly as possible. I know you're under some time constraint.
Thank you.
The first item on the list was a audit that the Secretary of State did at our surplus property office with respect to financial controls. The audit had no findings except to mention a management letter, which is also listed here. And I have to be honest with you, I don't know what the difference is, frankly, between an audit report and a management letter, because in my previous experience with the Budget Management Division, I would see management letters as those informational items to state management that were regarding subjects that weren't really of a level that should be in an audit report or that must be in an audit report. But I've seen this kind of ebb and flow, so I don't know. And so if you have a question about why it's a management letter, maybe that would be best put to the audit division. In any event, this management letter reads very much like an audit report, and frankly, the other experience I have is I'm not used to responding to management letters. In this one, however, we did.
Okay.
Again, I don't know what the distinction is, but it does exist, evidently.
Mr. Chair, just Representative Butler. Thank you. The audit finding recommends the management review the daily cash input documents and bank deposits for accuracy before deposits are made. The response is that we already do that. Was there some detail missing? Had we missed deposits, the amounts of deposits, had they been recorded inaccurately as we were managing the surplus property program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, thank you for the question. I think actually what happened here was the changes were being implemented as the audit was ongoing. And I think that's what, in my opinion, and I don't know this, obviously, but it's my opinion that that's what caused this to become a management letter as opposed to an audit report, because there would be no findings issued in the audit report.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, Representative Butler.
So in the past, perhaps then the daily cash input documents had not been reviewed, calculated correctly, and the bank deposits had not accurately reflected the amount that was on the deposit slip. Is that I'm having trouble with that, George. You're saying you were implementing it at the time. Was there a past practice to not do those kinds of things?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I believe that the new procedures greatly enhance and correct some of the deficiencies that had gone on in the past. Yes.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Dunford, the deficiencies of the past, were there amounts that were unaccounted for in the surplus property program that did not arrive at the bank?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, no, I'm not aware of that.
Okay. So the inaccuracies or inadequacies of the prior reporting system did not cost anybody anything. It was just sloppy accounting, perhaps.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I believe if you were to characterize the management of that program, that might be a good phrase to use.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I'll proceed then. The Representative Butler has graciously already taken the wind out of my sails on the first item on that list. So I'll move on to the second one.
Sorry.
As he is very gracious, since I have long experience with the Representative at Ways and Means, and I appreciate that experience. The second recommendation was to implement a programming change to the inventory and accounting system to ensure passwords were not displayed in clear text on the screens.
And is that supposed to be clear text, not clear test, right?
That is to be clear text.
Thank you.
Yes. Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And that is being worked on as we speak. You'll recall, many of you probably use the Windows operating system enough that if you sign in on a password, sometimes asterisks come up.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes clear text will come up as well, and that is a security breach if that happens. So we're working on that to fix that so it does not happen.
And the way we resolve that, Mr. Chair, is that we get a little sticky note and we place it right next to the screen. This is the password and the user's name is, so that it, when it just comes up and blank, then we'll be able to type it in.
And then whoever's standing behind you can read it so that they can come in from the other.
Anybody can read it.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, that would also be an audit finding if that were to happen. So, and by the way, we probably had that. So that we no longer at least recommend that anybody write their password and leave it in plain view for obvious reasons. The third recommendation...
George, before you move on, is there also a recommendation or a requirement that folks have to change their password at least every 30 days?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I don't know if it's every 30 days, but it is periodically, and it should be spelled out in policy in terms of when that should occur.
And it should. And is there also a policy that requires that they not use the same password a second time?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And is there also a policy that they should, that passwords such as password or their name or their birth date not be used as a password?
Mr. Chair, I don't know if that's actually written in the policy. I think we actually try to address this through training. You know, you raise a very good point. Many of us, and it's because it is difficult for us of advancing age to remember some of these passwords we come up with. So the birth date generally is one that doesn't escape us quickly. However, that's probably not a good idea to use that.
Mr. Chair, that's why we use the post-it notes we put on the front of the monitor to remind ourselves what we changed it to 2 months ago.
Well, I do have to admit to having a file in my, not here at the Capitol, but at home in my desk drawer that does have a list of my passwords, so I can remember which one I used where.
And Mr. Chair, no doubt it's the file's name is password. No,
actually, it's username and passwords.
Okay, and moving along, the third recommendation was to ensure that all adjustment and refund forms were complete, and that was actually completed in June of 2003, prior to the issuance of an audit report or while they were doing their ongoing audit activity. And the final recommendation involved keys and keys management to the warehouse and certain areas of the facility. And the bottom line there is we're very sensitive to the key issue. Facilities, Bill Foster's division has worked closely with the surplus property program to re-key locks when necessary when there are employment separations. And we have in the DAS internal audit group actually followed up on that, and they are in fact doing those things. So they are protecting state property as they should be.
George, has there been any kind of a move to go to a digital type of key system, even for the internal locks, as opposed to continuing with the traditional keys? The reason why I ask that is because that those systems can also create a log so that you can see when people are coming in and when they're moving about the building. And I'm just curious if there's been any discussion about moving in that direction.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. There's been discussion about it. It is a costly endeavor, as you can imagine, and it does not currently exist at surplus property, but it does exist in other areas of state government, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, frankly, because I don't know the technology behind this. I don't know if it's digitized information that's on the card or whether it's magnetic, but I do know that in a DAS, for instance, we do have a card that we use to get into the door during hours where the doors aren't unlocked. And there is, in fact, a log that's generated as a result of that activity. So we know, we don't know necessarily who it is, because if someone else is using your card, it'll appear as if you walked through the door, obviously.
Right.
But the bottom line is there's a note or an entry that at that moment in time the door was opened.
However, if somebody does report their card missing, it can be changed immediately so that that card is no longer can gain access to any facilities, and it's just a matter of going on your computer screen, or for the facilities person to go on a computer screen and make one change, and it's just basically delete or disable that particular employee's number. So if a person separates, if they've lost their card, if there's any kind of for whatever reason that it needs to be disabled, it can be done in a matter of seconds, actually.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct. Yes, it is very, very good for purposes of security to be able to do that.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
The next audit report, moving on, is the two-way radio communications audit report. And by the way, I did send Mr. Keller, I hope Mr. Keller got the links to these reports. Oh, very good. Because if you would, frankly, I think you would enjoy actually reading some of this, since I was forced to read all of them. I think you should enjoy some of them as well. The two-way radio communication report, in my estimation, was an enjoyable read for me, because I am not a technologist, and you'll note that for the record. But the only link in that report, and the recommendation there basically was to somehow manage these disparate organizations, Department of Transportation, State Police, State Forestry, Corrections, and other local emergency and other program providers that are local government, city governments, and county governments that use two-way radio communication. Other than the fact that the Department of Administrative Services may use some of these two-way radios in its facilities operation in order to make sure that buildings are maintained correctly and properly and promptly, we do not have any expertise in this area. The linchpin, if you read the report, the recommendation was the DASH should somehow oversee interoperability of two-way communication. It is only, and I am enough of a technologist to know that it's only recently that this interoperability actually technologically is possible. But I will tell you that the Departments of Transportation, State Police, Forestry, and those that were subject to this audit, they actually very effectively and efficiently use their two-way communication to do things such as make sure snow plows are in certain locations during inclement weather. In the Department of Transportation's case. The only linchpin, though, and I wanted to get to this because it was interesting to me as an attorney to actually read the portion of the report that suggests that DAS has a requirement of overseeing this. And by the way, this was not met with by kind ears either in terms of those folks that actually use this equipment, because they also know that we don't have any expertise in this area other than to use them ourselves from time to time. But the report talks about Chapter 283 of the Oregon Revised Statutes, and it quotes the requirement that DAS manage all telecommunications. But if you look at Oregon Revised Statute 283.140, it actually defines telecommunication. And I'm not a technologist, but I actually, as a lawyer, would say, I don't know if that actually would apply to two-way radios, because it talks about light waves, and I presume that would be fiber optic cable or something like that, and it talks about electrically generated.
George, can you give us that statute number again?
Chapter 283.140.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Dean Fuller.
I have a question, a little quirky, but I have the cold that I got from Representative Butler's grandfather.
No, I'm kidding.
He's sharing the wealth up here. Regarding that, does it apply to, does the statute, and I haven't looked at it yet, does that apply to cell phone? Does DAS review, question is, does DAS review, or whose responsibility is it to review the cell phone bills for agencies?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, thank you for that question as well, because I was just about to get to that. DAS does not review cell phone bills, nor does it necessarily participate in a broad way in selection of a cell phone provider. Although I know that the Information Resource Management Division is thinking about this. But if you think about cell phones, I believe cell phones operate on radio waves. And so, again, I don't know if the legislature, and you folks know much better than I do, obviously, whether you intended that DAS manage that.
Just a follow-up.
Follow-up, Representative.
Do you know when the statutes were adopted? Because if it was you know, 10 years ago, I don't think a lot of people were thinking about cell phones at the time.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I believe, and obviously when you check the statute at the very bottom, you'll see the chapter law and the date. I think it was updated in 1995, but the original statute probably dates back, you know, much earlier than that, maybe to the 70s, late 70s.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up comment on that. The reason I bring that up is my fair city, the city of Portland, the city that works, had a little incident a few years back that I remember where there was blatant cell phone usage violations. And my understanding, it's usually up to the manager who's signing off on the bill. And, you know, I think that's something that we certainly need to be aware of. And certainly those charges can rack up. So I think it's something we should look at. Maybe we need to expand the statute to include it.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, right now the agency is responsible for their cell phone bills, and ultimately the director of that agency or those agencies is responsible for that. So, yes, they are reviewed. I'm not suggesting they're not reviewed. They are. It's just they're not all reviewed by the Department of Administrative Services.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. One quick question about this is that... because the whole issue of interoperability we talked about last session some in the General Government Committee. And one of the things that we had stated that we really wanted to have was, for example, on the enhanced 911 system, the ability to, whether a person calls in from a landline cell phone, satellite phone, whatever kind of mechanism, that they are able to get assistance sent to them because they can be tracked. We know that the technology exists because that's precisely what organizations like OnStar, which is a General Motors product, utilizes, and they're using global positioning systems and that sort of thing. But has there been any further discussion on that you're aware of, George? And the other thing is that since Department of Administrative Services is not really competent to deal with to do, and I don't mean that in a derogatory way, it's just a statement of fact, to deal with this, would it be better to hand it off to somebody like Emergency Management Services, who really has more of the technology base and departmental competence to deal with some of these things?
Mr. Chair, I think that's a very good question. I have to tell you, it's my opinion. And first, let me tell you, I'm not aware of any further discussions on the 911 question you had, but that doesn't mean they aren't ongoing.
Okay.
I'm not so sure I would be aware of those. If you'd like, I'd be happy to find out for you and report back to Mr. Keller for the committee. It's up to you.
If you know who to contact, that'd be terrific.
I'll make a note, and I'll do that for the committee.
Thank you.
Very quickly, by the way. You know, let me just say there is the State Interoperability Executive Council that was created pursuant to an executive order under Governor Kitzhaber. And that group, that committee, was vehement in their response to this audit report in terms of their current consensus organization. They share information. They obviously know what they're talking about and know what they do. They're the agencies of both local and state governments that use two-way radio communication. But to actually get to your question, I think if this committee has the time, it may want to explore, speaking both to those DAS experts that may be out there in the Information Resource Management Division and the Emergency Management Office of the state to determine, you know, what best road should be taken with respect to your earlier 911 question and other interoperability issues. My only point here, frankly, is that I don't know if the audit report, as stated, really lends much help to the subject.
Okay. Thank you.
And by the way, DAS did not, this is not a DAS response, although DAS may have put it together. Ultimately, it was a response from this State Interoperability Executive Council and the individual departments involved.
Okay. Thank you.
Moving on to the... next item is the report on the State of Oregon's Comprehensive Annual Financial Statement, or Financial Report, for year ended June 30th, 2003. It's good that there are no findings on that. The bottom line is the Secretary of State has opined that that report accurately and fairly states the state's financial position as of that date. The next audit is the Oregon State Hospital and Oregon State Penitentiary use of overtime. I call these are more in the line of, rather than financial audits, of a performance audit. The recommendation stemming from that audit was very simply management develop policies and guidelines to assist state managers in effectively managing overtime use. I tabbed a specific reference, but I just would like to read into the record, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
With respect to the response. The Department of Human Services responded that in 2002, Oregon State Hospital leadership limited overtime to not exceed 3 shifts per week. The decision was challenged by labor unions, and Oregon State Hospital ultimately had to rescind this decision. We will begin discussions about overtime management options and language suitable for future contract negotiations. The Department of Corrections responded that regarding excessive overtime, we agree we should work with Department of Administrative Services and labor for a remedy. However, it may be difficult to overcome the seniority-based provisions in the labor contracts that cover overtime assignments. I read those to you because I want to make sure the committee understands that looking at this, as I did from an outside perspective, and also long years in budget and management, I want to make sure you understand that I don't think this report meant to convey that people just aren't managing staff. But I think that the reader could walk away from that report wondering about that. There are many issues involved in managing overtime. Certainly, the Human Resources Services Division at the Department of Administrative Services should provide some policy and oversight in terms of training of managers in the use of scheduling overtime. And I believe there were some situations, isolated as they were, that had occurred at both the hospital and the correctional institution. But I want to make sure the committee knows that I'm not sitting here suggesting that I agree with the flavor of that audit report. And that's merely an editorial from me, because I know that's not something that necessarily is germane to the issue today.
Chair.
Representative Butler.
George, what oar in the water does Human Service Resource Division have in the negotiation of those contracts which dictate the amount of seniority and allocations of overtime?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I'm not a labor lawyer, but I will say to you that I presume that it's a bargainable issue, and it's one of those things that is either thrown on or taken off the table. And I'm not privy to the collective bargaining that goes on. So, and I'm not suggesting that's the root of all evil as well. I'm just merely suggesting to you that the report, when you read it, and if you read it, I'd invite you to, because I want you to read it from our perspective as well. And from our perspective, it's very simply we provide the policy and the oversight and as much training as possible. But it is very difficult to absolutely root out every single instance of inappropriate use of overtime.
Mr. Chair, if I could continue that line of questioning, though, it seems like that the Human Resource Service Division should have a place at the table if you're going to be held accountable for the results. So if you're dealt this hand and then are criticized for and although it being, you know, not a fatal criticism, but are criticized for the lack of management of developing or of the guidelines to oversee this issue of overtime at the state hospital or at the Oregon State Penitentiary, then you ought to be able to have some oversight in that process. So I guess the question is, Department of Administrative Services has a place at the table in those negotiations, but the Human Resource Service Division does not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, no, I'm sorry, I don't mean to imply that. The Human Resource Services Division, which is part of the Department of Administrative Services, has within it the labor relations unit, and they conduct the collective bargaining from the management perspective. So, yes, we have the oar in the water, so to speak, to the extent that we are available. But we know, I should say, they know what is on and off the table as far as negotiation. But I'm suggesting to you that it is a little more complex than merely writing a policy and then rooting out all the improper and inappropriate uses of overtime in state government.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess, and George, your background both with law and accounting probably could lend you to be able to say then, is the method by which that is being negotiated at present or within the contracts, does it cost us more in the use of the overtime? As opposed to using regular time when it would be a better policy to use overtime or to use regular time.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I think the audit correctly found instances where overtime was inappropriately used, and I think it stemmed from either poor planning on the management perspective or no planning. In any event, I'm suggesting to you that I don't take issue with the instances they uncovered, and I think that's valuable for management to know. I'm suggesting to you, though, that to draw more from the report than just those specific instances, I think is to read something into the report findings that don't exist or may not exist, because there are other issues involved besides just managing people in terms of overtime. That's a collective bargaining issue, and not something that I'm well versed in speaking about, frankly. I just know it exists.
Thank you. I think from that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to guess that basically what to boil that down so that I could understand it would be that the contract provides that they will be, that certain people by seniority or other kinds of gyrations within the contracts provide who will get the overtime if there is overtime, and that sometimes it wasn't managed in such a fashion to avoid the overtime to start off with.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I think that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Rosenbaum has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It looks like this audit predates the current controversy over the state hospital, both in the press and then subsequently here. Is there anything that has come out then that would change these findings or shed more light on what you determined?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, thank you for the question. I don't know, to tell you the truth. I left the Department of Human Services a couple of years ago, and I really honestly haven't kept up with the changes that have gone on there, so I can't answer that question.
Okay,
if asking the chair and the committee's indulgence, I'll proceed. The next report on the list is the Federal Compliance Report, which is actually a, for lack of better terminology, a subset of the Comprehensive Annual Financial Statement financial report that the Secretary of State issues on a yearly basis. This report that I just discussed comes out a few months generally after the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report. There are a few findings here that I think are worthy of note. They, for the most part, involve the Information Resource Management Division, but we'll start first with the Archive Center. The recommendation was to reevaluate our use of the Data Archive Center in light of the state's current backup archiving and recovery needs. We did not take issue with that. We agree. Part of this is tied up right now in the data consolidation process, because until the data consolidation process actually comes to fruition, I don't think we know precisely what kinds of backup needs the state has. They're working on that right now. I think it's, if I recall the project timeline, it should be the beginning of the implementation of that consolidation has occurred now, obviously, with the certificates of participation being issued to build the center that will house the equipment and the people. But I think
the center is under construction and the walls are up, is my understanding.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct. My understanding as well. But I believe that we'll actually start seeing things come out of that building sometime in June of this year. So assuming things stay on schedule. So this issue will be more precisely dealt with, I guess, is a short answer, as part of that ongoing process of managing the consolidation of the data centers.
Mr. Chair, what portion of the of the audit was dealt, if any, with the warm site at Burns, the archive center, the state's archive center there, and the operation of that.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, this first recommendation actually does deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, again, it is something that the Information Resource Management Division is working on, but is not prepared at this point to say we have finished our look at this and we're going to do one or the other with that site, because they may have a need for that site after the consolidation effort is finished.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm anxious about the fact that we're running a corporation that's a little bit bigger than Coca-Cola in some respects, and those folks are backing up information on a very regular basis on a remote site, and we've got the remote site, and I'm anxious about the backup, and the law currently provides that I think that lottery back up actually on a daily basis at that particular warm site. So the concern I've got is that with an operation this big, with information this vulnerable, and particularly in light of some of the seismic activity that we're trying to retrofit our buildings for in this valley, that we do continue with the original non-seismic or seismic approved area of the state, which is out in the great deserts of the original Great Lake that was there, that very stable place and one of the most stable places in the entire state, and that's where the lines with double redundancy now are located. I'm anxious for the well-being of this information that the state has.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, thank you for the comment. We're anxious about it as well, obviously, and we have a great interest in it, and this has come to light a couple of times in a couple of different audits, so it is on our radar screen, I assure you. And I also have to say, of course, your district would be the most stable in the state that I'm aware of. It's also the largest district, if I remember right, too.
It is indeed. Mr. Chair, I'd also say that, you know, for those folks that are anxious about this, because there are companies out of state in British Columbia that will actually allow us to archive that information. I would just assume, number one, that the employees be in state, and number two, the difference in where you store it is stored at basically the speed of light. And so if we can continue to store it in state with state support and employees, people who are paying Oregon taxes, I'd sure prefer to do that. And yes, it is the most stable, not because it's in-house District 60, but because that's just part of the Great Basin as well. I guess that's the word I'm looking for. That's part of the original Great Basin where Salt Lake was. Thank you.
Thank you. George, let me have you hang on for just a second before you continue. We're going to lose a couple of our members, and I would like to very quickly, if you'll indulge us for a moment, I'd like to recess the informational meeting and go to the letter to OUS and get input from the committee on that. So let me recess the informational meeting on Department of Administrative Services. And members, you have before you a draft of a letter to the co-chairs of Ways and Means and the members of the Committee on Ways and Means it would be coming from the House Audits Committee with regards to the Oregon University System audit that we took up last week. Without reading the letter to you, I don't think that that's necessarily appropriate. What I would like to find out, though, is that I would like to ask for a consensus. I don't think this is anything that we have to actually vote on, but I would like to just ask for a consensus of this letter going out to the Joint Ways and Means Committee from this committee over my signature.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the work that has been done by the Chair and putting the letter together based upon the hearings which we had and held last week, through last week. One thing I would suggest that there was a difference of opinion presented in the hearing. The Oregon University System had their particular take from the information that Mr. Bryan testified to according to the timelines. And so certainly the as to the first paragraph, this is according to the testimony of the Secretary of State's Audit Division. These increases were awarded to selected employees during a time of statewide salary freezes. Their position, the university's position, as I recall, was that that they did agree that there were increases and raises given during that particular time. The largest portion of those had been agreed to before the and had actually been worked up, as I recall, had actually been worked up in paperwork form and had been approved, but had not been submitted before the actual budget note occurred. So the Secretary of State's position is what's being presented here, and that's with regard to the first paragraph. That was something that I just noted on my copy of it.
So what do I hear you saying, that you would like me to include put the departmental, summarize the departmental response?
Well,
to the Secretary of State's
I don't know that it's necessary, but if we
just reference
that the according to the testimony from the Secretary of State's division, this was their position. And then, the balance of it, even down to, for instance, on number four in the second paragraph, according to the Secretary, it says, due to the roll-up costs. Again, this is according to the Secretary of State's audit findings and projections. We don't know what those roll-up costs were. In fact, the university's position was that there had been errors on just two of the salaries, and they had been adjusted. I think there was a couple hundred dollars. And then with regard, I thought the testimony regarding number five was that the salary hikes that were involved, I didn't recall 3,000.
I did go back and listen to the tape, and they did make the comment that many, and I thought that they said 3,000 or 3,500 or so had gotten salary hikes, and I remember that I questioned them on this because they talked about their October or November checks having an increase of $50 per month. So that would actually be a it wasn't a one-time payment. Just that. So and I'll go back. I can go back and check those numbers.
I would appreciate that, Mr. Chair. There was a response, and I guess it's who you're listening to at the time, mm-hmm. that if we present both sides of it, or the Secretary of State's side, I do know that in the interim audit committee, I think that Ways and Means had an opportunity to question both the Oregon University system and the Secretary of State's audit division, and felt that a portion of the university position, the Oregon University's position, was more credible than the audit finding relative to some of these issues. So I just bring that out because they have found in the interim, in the interim audit committee, that the university's position with regard to this was different than the Secretary of State's audit division.
Yes, that is correct. Other comments? And as far as the Representative Rosenbaum, did you have
a suggestion?
I don't have my hand up.
Okay, I didn't know if I saw your hand go up or not. Any other?
No, I just said those. I would concur with those suggestions because it was presented by the Secretary of State, and we should make sure and present the university's response, I think, at least in the letter.
We can do that. I will make those changes, and then bring another draft back on Thursday for your clear consideration.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, and thank you for being here today. And we'll see you Thursday. Oh, one other thing before you leave, let me just, because of the we've got a couple of bills that we're taking up on Thursday as well, mm-hmm. and because of that, there is a booklet that you all should have copies of, and if you don't have copies of, then give Jim a call and he can round them up for you. It's the Review of Small Regulatory Agencies. This was a Joint Legislative Audit Committee report from December of 2004. You might want to just peruse that. And I have read the report with regards to small agencies, but because of the bill that we're taking up, this may be referenced when we're having the discussion about that. And again, there's no work sessions. It will just be a public hearing. But I just want to mention to you that you might want to peruse that and then bring it with you on Thursday.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Would it be possible to drop off a copy in your offices? Thank you.
Okay. With that, then, thank you, George. Thank you very much for indulging me. And let's see. I'm going to reopen the informational hearing on the audit reports for Dennis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, George Dunford, Department of Administrative Services, Internal Audit Manager. Continuing on with the federal compliance report discussion that we left off.
Yes.
The second recommendation from that report was that the department develop and adopt by rule policies, procedures, and standards guidelines to plan for, acquire, implement, and manage the state's information resources. The department agreed with that recommendation and is in the process of doing just that.
Okay.
Don Fleming, the as you all know, the new chief information officer for the state, is actively engaged in not only the data center consolidation project, but a variety of other pressing issues at the Information Resource Management Division, one of which is this.
Go ahead.
The third recommendation was that the department adopt an agency-wide comprehensive system development lifecycle methodology to include specific policies and procedures to govern all aspects and phases of the system development lifecycle regarding software development. The department's position on that was to agree with reservations. The report, in our opinion, did not include any reference to the fact that we have taken significant steps to improve our software development lifecycle methodology and the controls of system development, which are being worked on a daily basis at the Information Resource Management Division.
George, with regard to the recovery of the $70,000 paid in error, was that successfully recovered?
Mr. Chair, that is the reason we agree with reservation. It is our position that that was not improperly paid, and we have worked with the Attorney General's office to resolve that issue. The work was performed, and we paid the bill.
So the audit finding, they found that it was not properly paid, or properly paid, the work wasn't performed and delivered, and your position is that it was performed, delivered, and paid appropriately?
Mr. Chair, our position actually is that it was performed and it was paid for. The improper nature of that finding, and I'm not speaking for the Secretary of State's office, but in my opinion, was the fact that it was for work that was done for the state prior to the date implementation, or prior to the signature date on the contract.
I see.
So it was more of a technical issue than it was a substantive one for purposes of the business that provided the service to the state.
Which would demonstrate a shortcoming, perhaps, in the contracting method that was used.
Yes, Mr. Chair, no question. We, as you know, work hard and diligently not to make those kinds of errors. However, from time to time, they do occur.
Thank you.
The last recommendation with respect to this audit report was that the department further review and revise its rate-setting models for the division to ensure that, speaking of the Information Resource Management Division, to ensure that it equitably and accurately recover the costs associated with services provided. Again, we do not disagree with that. It's a good finding, and it's something we're actively engaged in, as you know, Mr. Chair, right now, because it is the budget season, and we have analysts actually working on recasting some of the Information Resource Management Division budget, not just because of the data center consolidation project that's ongoing, but because we want to get a better handle on what our actual costs and what the rates should actually be. The next audit is the data integrity audit that was done on the state financial management application, what you commonly hear referred to as SFMA. The recommendation from that report suggested the department define in policy the specific financial information that must be documented and retained in order for supporting documentation to be considered adequate. This has been done. The background for this, for your information, is that although there are approximately 7 million transactions in what we call the data mart, the information floating around in the cyber world, for lack of a better word, since I'm not a technologist, the auditors, I don't think, found any issue with respect to information being placed in the data mart and information coming out of the data mart. The data did not change character in any way, shape, or form. But they did find, when they tested 743 transactions out of that 7 million transaction pool, they did find that a large majority, 70% of them, coming from the agencies into the data mart, into the statewide financial management application, did not have the requisite supporting documentation. And so the State Controller's Division has worked hard to make sure that doesn't happen again. But the good news is that the state system itself is fine. The next audit is more in the vein of a performance audit as well, and that is the debt collections. The title of the audit, of course, is The Progress Made, But Opportunities for Improvement Still Exist. There are four recommendations in that audit. The bottom line is three of those have we agreed, and we have made those changes. The fourth one is the more contentious one, and although we're not contentious about it at all, we are in the process of trying to implement that recommendation, and that is the vendor offset provision. So, for instance, when a contractor works for the state of Oregon, that contractor gets paid for that work provided the state. The state currently does not now, except through a pilot program, which I believe has ended, does not now first check to see whether or not that contractor owes the state any money, and that's sitting currently in our accounts receivable. Our accounts receivable right now, and by the way, for your edification, Mr. Chair, it's important to note that the your legislative fiscal office does an excellent report on the accounts receivable each year, and it's on their website. And if you'd like, I will send Mr. Kelly the link to that as well.
That'd be terrific.
But that actually details the majority of those data come from the Department of Administrative Services, of course. But it really details in a management from a management perspective what the state of your accounts receivable are, where they're located. It gives it to you by fund type, and I know Representative Butler would be interested in this. It's roughly 30% of that $1.5 billion is general fund in terms of what's out there, and 95% of that. Is money that is due, as you can imagine, to the Department of Revenue.
Now, let me make sure, George, that I understand this correctly. So what you're saying is that if there is a vendor that has provided services or products to the state that but yet owes the state money for whatever reason, whether it be taxes or fees or whatever, this is not an assessment to these vendors. This is if they owe the state money, then being able to in the payment for their services or products that they've provided, being able to withhold the amount that is owed, and then paying the vendor the balance. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, Mr. Chair, you are. For instance, the example would be child support enforcement. You're a vendor that works for the state. You haven't paid your child support. Right now, there's a reason for this. It is not because you have these recalcitrant state management bureaucrats that don't want to do this. The bottom line is it does cost money to change the statewide system. And currently we don't write checks because we're decentralized, for the most part, as you know, well know. We don't write checks in one central location. Right. So it is difficult to check child support against the vendor payment we make to a contractor providing services to the state. it goes beyond just income tax recovery. And don't forget, these were liquidated claims as well. So I'm not suggesting that we're advocating that we offset willy-nilly in terms of what we think someone owes the state. These are liquidated claims, which, you know, simply means there is no contest. There is no litigable right left with respect to that claim. The money is owed. The state hasn't collected it. So it's a bigger issue than merely, by the way, the report suggests that we look at certain states, Utah. Although they didn't mention Texas. Texas is one. Texas is a state that actually issues a warrant for as payment, and then the warrant is delivered or taken to their Department of Revenue, and they can easily check at that point whether or not any taxes or other obligations that the Department of Revenue knows about in the state of Texas are offset prior to the warrant being honored.
Okay.
But again, those are specific examples. We are well aware of those examples, and we understand them, and we have been looking at this for some time. I think we're at the point to actually finish the study portion of this sometime later this summer and actually make recommendations to the state controller. But it is something that we're fully aware of, and it's not something, frankly, that is an easy fix. Although it does seem intuitively to me a fix that should be made.
George, because of the abilities of electronic transfers and processes, would it be unreasonable for the state to go to a centralized, for lack of a better term, check writing system, so that you've got a contractor that or a vendor that has provided services to pick an agency. Name your agency here. And so then they electronically send the approval for that payment to a central place that then actually either electronically pays the vendor directly into their account or does write a check and mails it out. Is there? I know the technology exists to do it.
Mm-hmm.
The question is it something that would make sense for the state?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. I think this committee should engage in a conversation with John Radford, the state controller. But let me say prior to you summoning Mr. Radford to the table that I think unreasonable or reasonable may be defined differently by two different people depending on how many dollars you're talking about. Because I agree, the technology certainly exists. The question is, are we able to purchase that technology? And I know that Mr. Radford has considered exactly what you've talked about and is considering that. But again, at some point in time, as Representative Butler knows, you do end up before a Ways and Means Subcommittee with a policy package on something like this.
Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you. Because of the lack of centralization that we have in the payment process, George, I'm assuming it is possible for the same vendor to be drawing payments from various different branches at the same time for work periods which might overlap, and or for product delivered which obviously could overlap. Have you ever seen that as a problem?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, no, I haven't. I actually don't think that wouldn't concern me as much as the item that the recommendation we're talking about today, and that is how do you implement successfully a vendor offset program to capture whatever is owed to that specific agency. And don't forget, you folks know much better than I do, one of the great things about decentralization, frankly, is it allows this body, this decision-making body, the legislature, to look at individual portions and pieces of state government. And you do so through your very, very many separate appropriation bills because you comb the individual agencies. The downside to that, of course, is you don't have as much centralization when you have an outfit or a system that operates like that. So there are pluses and minuses to both, and certainly any of us could make arguments either way. But in this specific case, some kind of vendor offset implementable system, I think, would be advantageous, and I think you'll see the state controller move towards that.
Follow up, Representative Butler. Thank you, Mr. Chair. George, in that process, we're required to gather information, I-9 information, on each of the vendors. Do we ever match the I-9 information with other Social Security information and W-2 information so that there's any kind of a cross-match to make certain that we don't have someone who is providing a service for one department or as an employee of one department and providing services or as an employee of another department at the same time? Do we do that cross-match?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, with respect to the state payroll system, I'm sure we do. And those are the instances when that's most likely to occur. But remember, agencies, I think, define vendors differently. When I was an employee at the Department of the Department of Human Resources, if I received a travel reimbursement, which I did once, I think on their file I'm a vendor as well. But for purposes of payroll, that's centralized.
Thank you.
Okay, moving along here, out of deference to your time. And I appreciate the time, by the way, Mr. Chair, and the committee has given me. And I apologize for my...
you're doing fine, because I think that's the purpose of this committee, is to be looking in depth at these things. And so we're not going to get too excited about that. And I think that knowing that we only have, about 15 minutes left. What we don't get through today, if you would be in agreement to, George, I'd like what we'll do is schedule a time for you to come back and finish up this report probably on Thursday, either Thursday or next Tuesday, that way, because we really do want to get in depth with this material. So
perhaps Mr. Dunford would be at 100%. He said he was 80% earlier. By Thursday, he'd be up to 100%.
So with that in mind, George, what we'll do is when you think that we're at kind of a natural stopping point, we can what we'll do is stop. But let's go ahead and go with the human resources.
Well, Mr. Chair, let me ask you. We have sick leave management to go through.
Uh-huh.
And then the last report is the longest one, and that's the data center controls review. And that has 25 findings.
You know what? Let's do then.
Should we stop with the sick leave report?
Let's do the sick leave report and then stop at that one, and then we can on Thursday or Tuesday we'll pick up the other report.
Certainly, that's fine.
That will work.
The last report that I'll talk about this morning then is the sick leave management report, which was issued in October of 2004. I will tell you that the recommendations that stem from that are very broad and very general. For instance, the first one is the department should analyze options such as buyback, bonus, conversion, and paid leave bank programs, develop a strategy for reducing sick leave use, and seek legislative approval as needed. Okay, well, that's easily done, as you know. Let me give you some background on this report. The Audits Division did took a look at Bureau of Labor Statistics data and found that the government sector across the nation used about 2% of gross payroll for sick leave benefits. And then they looked at our payroll database and found that Oregon uses approximately 0.3% more than that, 2.3%. And they valued that at somewhere between $14 and $16 million. The issue that we take with this report isn't that we agree sick leave should be managed, it should be managed efficiently, it should be managed effectively. So we don't disagree with that. Please remember that. But after working long and hard on this report with the Secretary of State's office, I have to tell you that when you look at individual data on agencies, and we've agreed to do exactly what they've said, we will look at and strengthen policy where necessary. We're in the process of doing that right now. So take that off the table. We're doing it. But the Department of Administrative Service sick leave percentage for 2002 was 2.1%. For 2003, it was 2.2%. The Secretary of State's office was at the Oregon averaged 2.3% in 2002, and it went up a percent as we did 2.4% in 2003. I would suggest to you that the state's cost in sick leave can't be merely a simple look at how much, what percent or the number of hours out of 100 you spend in terms of paying somebody while they're on leave, sick leave in particular. We are also trying to improve our coding, the data coding in the individual agencies with respect to the Federal Medical Leave and the Oregon Medical Leave Act, because those are extended periods that are taken, and sometimes those are coded as sick leave. And obviously that skews this substantially, in our opinion. And we're looking to see if we can actually identify those cases and work with those agencies to make sure that doesn't happen in the future. There are agencies such as forestry, however, that are at 1.8%, below the national average. So we intend to work with folks that are below the national average to see what it is they do that keeps their sick leave rate lower. So we're well aware that it's something we should be doing. The other thing, the last thing I want to leave you with respect to sick leave is that is not a benefit that is part of our comprehensive statewide financial statement. We don't have an item on the financial statement that says sick leave accrued benefits with a dollar amount, because that is part of our personal services budget already. So when you think about this, the only legitimate or rational cost you have when someone doesn't come to work and calls in sick is if you are at a 24/7 institutional setting, when you've got to somehow backfill that use of that position, you will have extraordinary cost at that point. That's not part of the budgeted personal services. Okay, I'm not suggesting the money's not there. I'm suggesting that the money is there always, because this is not something that actually impacts our financial statement. So we are working on that, and with that, I'll be happy to take further questions or close at your option, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Are there any other questions for George about this, Representative Butler?
Very, very excellent presentation. I appreciate George coming in, even when he's only working on 8 of his 10 cylinders. So.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Butler.
And I appreciate it as well. Jim?
Under the notice rule, this is a continuation, so even though we do not have 48 hours, we can schedule the continuation for Thursday if that works for you.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Keller, I'm fine with Thursday. Okay. I'm happy to come back. I very much like to testify, as you probably can tell, so I'm happy to come back and do that.
Yes, you do seem to be having quite a good time there. No, I appreciate that. And if we can do that, then my preference would be to go ahead and get through this so that the committee has this background as we're moving on with other things.
I'll show you guys agenda today.
Great.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, George. I appreciate it. And I would just make one point on the record before we leave sick leave management, and that is with regards to the paid leave bank programs. I think, you know, if I'm understanding that correctly, that can be a very beneficial program for employees that get that have some kind of a major illness to which they may or may not be able to return, but especially for an employee that has, you know, they're within months of being able to retire, but they've gotten sick, they've gotten early Alzheimer's, or any number of conditions that would keep them from being able to fulfill. And if people that have banked time can donate it to them so that they can finish out that, you know, that time under sick leave and then go ahead and retire, I think that's a benefit for the employee that is a compassionate benefit that the employer can offer. So I just put that out on the table. And that's if I've understood that what they're suggesting they're correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay. With that, we are going to we will finish up for today. We will be back here on Thursday. We have a couple of bills that we're going to be hearing, and as I mentioned, the other report, and then we'll finish up with George on the report. Thank you, sir. Appreciate that. And with that, we will stand adjourned.